and welcome to another festive edition of Food for Thought here on Siren FM. I'm Charlotte Reed, and last week on the show I found out how to prepare all the essentials for Christmas dinner. This week is a bit different, as I have been finding out what to do if you want a vegetarian Christmas this year, as well as reviewing Christmas food right here in Lincoln.
Siren 107.3 FM.
So this is a bit of a different start to Food for Thought from usual this week. While the Lincoln Christmas Market was around, the Museum of Lincolnshire Life held a Victorian Christmas. I spoke to the museum to find out about what food the Victorians ate to celebrate this time of year, and we'll hear more about that later. But first, to set the mood, when you think of Christmas, you think of the Charles Dickens tale A Christmas Carol, which of course is a Victorian novel. So this is our managing editor, Andrew David, reading a part of the book where the Cratchits, who are the poor family in the book, are about to tuck into their Christmas dinner.
There never was such a goose. Bob said he didn't believe there ever was such a goose cooked. Its tenderness and flavour, size and cheapness, were the themes of universal admiration. Eked out by applesauce and mashed potatoes, it was a sufficient dinner for the whole family. Indeed, as Mrs. Cratchit said, with great delight, surveying one small atom of a bone upon the dish, they hadn't ate it all up at last. Yet everyone had had enough, and the youngest Cratchits in particular were steeped in sage and onion to the eyebrows. But now, the plates being changed by Miss Belinda, Mrs. Cratchit left the room alone, too nervous to bear witness to take the pudding up and bring it in. Suppose it should not be done enough? Suppose it should break in turning out? Suppose somebody should have got over the wall of the backyard and stolen it while they were merry with the goose? A supposition at which the two young Cratchits became livid. All sorts of horrors were supposed. Hello! A great deal of steam. The pudding was out of the copper. A smell like a washing day. That was the cloth. A smell like an eating house and a pastry cook's the next door to each other, with a laundress's next door to that. That was the pudding. In half a minute, Mrs. Cratchit entered, flushed but smiling proudly, with the pudding like a speckled cannonball so hard and firm, blazing in half of half a quartern of ignited brandy, and bedlit with Christmas holly stuck into the top. Oh, a wonderful pudding, Bob Cratchit said, and calmly too, that he regarded it as the greatest success achieved by Mrs. Cratchit since their marriage. Mrs. Cratchit said that, now the weight was off her mind, she would confess that she had her doubts about the quality of flour. Everybody had something to say about it, but nobody said or thought it was at all a small pudding for a large family. It would have been flatly hearsay to do so. Any Cratchit would have blushed to hint at such a thing.
Many of our ideas about how to celebrate Christmas come from the Victorians. I wanted to find out what sorts of foods they expected to have on their dinner table during the winter holiday. So I chatted to Theresa Workman, the Collections Access Officer at the Museum of Lincolnshire Life, to find out more.
The traditional Christmas that we would picture is the Christmas that the Victorians created. So we are very much following along the lines of what was invented during the Victorian period. So they would have expected a Christmas dinner very much like what we would have today. The mince pies, the Christmas pudding would have all been part of the experience. And from rich to poor, during the Victorian time, it was expected that every family would somehow manage to have a decent meal on Christmas Day, even if that was very unlikely to happen during the rest of their year. There would have been a difference in the experience between rich and poor. If we think about the poorest, the people who lived in the workhouses, the rest of the year they would have pretty much survived on watery soups and gruel. But even in that miserable place, on Christmas Day, every stop was pulled out, and they were usually given a roast beef dinner, followed by a Christmas pudding, and even some port to drink. At the other end of the scale, you've got the very well-off families who would have really been going for something ostentatious, quite wasteful. There would have been as many roast birds as they could fit on the table, surrounded by sausages and different types of meats. The meat feast comes down from much earlier pagan ceremonies and celebrations that happened at Christmas time, and that would have been the Roman Saturnalia and the midwinter feast. So this idea of having almost more meat than you could eat came back from a long time ago. But certainly the richer Victorian family would have then followed that with a nice Christmas pudding. They liked the idea of embellishing things, so they'd have popped little silver charms or sixpences into the Christmas pudding while it was being made, and you'd have been lucky if you found one while you were eating it, if you didn't choke on it, of course. Mince pies were also known as wayfarer pies because you made them with the intention that they were what you gave to visitors. And there was a tradition that if you ate 12 mince pies at 12 different houses through the 12 days of Christmas, then it would bring you happiness for the next 12 months. So all of those nice treats that we look forward to were all being enjoyed by the Victorians, just in a slightly different way.
And so why was it important, whether you were rich or poor or anything in between, to make sure you actually celebrated Christmas and to actually sort of try and pull out all the stops for it?
Well, strangely enough, prior to the Victorian era, nobody really took much notice of Christmas. It wasn't a recognised festival on the calendar. There were much more important festivals that people made a lot more effort for. But in Victorian times, it became fashionable to raise up the status of Christmas. There were a couple of leading characters that drove that sort of interest. One of them being Charles Dickens. He wrote A Christmas Carol, and he was a real reformer, and he wanted to make the well-off far more aware of the plight of the poor. And it was through his stories and his columns that he sort of tugged on the heartstrings of the better-off Victorians. And even if they didn't manage to be very generous throughout the rest of the year, they did take a pride in making contributions to make sure that the poorer did do well at Christmas. So it was the beginnings of creating this sort of charitable awareness in people.
I suppose, yeah, because that's essentially what the character of Scrooge does in A Christmas Carol, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, exactly. It hadn't been very much earlier in that century that people didn't even have a day off for Christmas. It was the Industrial Revolution that introduced this paid day off. And for a long time, there was a big resentment by the employers and the rich that they had to pay a day's wage for no work. So this is where the Scrooge image comes from. And then you gradually see into the household of the poor family in the book, and it created this feeling that of one day of the year, everybody was entitled to a decent meal at least. And obviously, people were very religious back in Victorian times, and Christmas Day did involve a visit to the church in the morning. But strangely enough, the cards and the traditions that the Victorians brought us were very secular. They weren't really to do with the birth of Jesus or any of that side of it. It was all much more about enjoying yourself and looking forward to the spring.
So they kind of brought along this idea of enjoying the day, but without particularly attaching more religious aspects to it.
Yes, that's right. And I find that quite surprising, but yeah, that's certainly the case. We have original Victorian Christmas cards here, and I haven't seen a single one that has any kind of religious image on it. And the messages are all very much, you know, wishing you a happy and prosperous sort of new year and looking forward to spring. So it was very much along the lines of the older festivals, which were about using up all of the meat because you'd had to slaughter the animals that you weren't going to be able to feed through the winter. So that was where the feast came from. And it was all about thinking, well, we're halfway through the winter now, we can start to look forward to things improving.
And do you think that's maybe why Christmas traditions haven't changed a great deal from the Victorian era? Because they're just about enjoying the day and they're not particularly tied down to any particular feelings of the time.
I do. I think that we get to this point in the year, which can be pretty miserable when you look outside, and it must have been even worse in times gone by when we didn't have the heat and the security that we have these days. And the thought of, you know, getting through the second half and things getting better must have been so important to people.
That was me chatting to Teresa Workman about what Victorians would traditionally have for their Christmas dinner. Generally, you can notice when Christmas is approaching, as the shops manage to make most things they sell Christmas-themed. This even happens to sandwiches, and for the past 3 years, Adam Best has been tasting these sandwiches to find out which are the best and which are the worst. He kindly spoke to me last week, and I started off by asking him why he started reviewing Christmas sandwiches.
The reason why I started was because, number one reason was because I had time on my hands, and I think it's always good to sort of make time have a direction as opposed to just waste it. And then the second reason was because there's loads of Christmas sandwiches and I really like the taste of Christmas sandwiches. I really like the taste of Christmas. But I was aware of the differential between them. I was aware of, you know, how different Christmas sandwiches can be from provider to provider. And I decided, I took it upon myself with some cajoling from some pals of mine to eat all of them, because I think it's important that people have an idea of what's good and what's not good.
And so how do you let people know your sort of judgment on different types of Christmas sandwiches?
I go to great lengths to write proper reviews about them, and then I take to social media and I beg people to sort of to look at my blog that I have, which is christmassandwichindex.blogspot.co.uk. So, I mean, it started off for the first 2 years that I did it. It was just sort of to amuse myself and my pals on Facebook. And then this year I did it, and I wanted to sort of, because it was my third season, I wanted to try and get it out to more people if possible. My ultimate ambition is to get on the One Show. I mean, that's never going to happen. It would be excellent, but I don't think it'll ever happen. But, I mean, it was cool this year because the people at the poke.co.uk, I got in contact with them in November and just said, because they supported the blog last year, and I said, Would there be any chance that you'd like to carry this in any sort of format on your website? Because I was maybe just thinking they'd have it as their blog of the week that they did last year, or maybe they might decide to post it up there every day. And the nice man at the Poke said, yeah, we think it's a really cool idea. We'd actually like to go one step further and make little short videos, which are the videos that you've seen.
And have people said that they found your reviews helpful or entertaining?
I'm actually, in as much as they're written quite lightheartedly, I'm pretty serious about the whole thing. So I think whenever people read them, or when they watch certainly when they watch the videos, because Simon is hilarious. I mean, he's just a funny guy, very naturally funny guy. I think people might find them entertaining, but I also hope that people can look at them, read their views, and sort of watch the videos and get an idea of honestly, what is a good sandwich and what isn't a good sandwich, because I think that's the point. I mean, in as much as I want everybody to have a nice time and enjoy watching the videos and enjoy reading the blog, I actually do want them to go out and be able to make an informed choice during their lunch break. Because, I mean, if you're going to go and spend £3.50 or £4 on a sandwich and a bag of crisps, it's good that you spend it in the right way and not go and spend it on muck.
So how do you judge the sandwiches?
I've got three factors and they all begin with F. So the first is festivity, which is how festive the packaging is. So I look at the box of the sandwich, and for me, the gaudier the better. I want to see pictures of Santa. I want to see penguins in like bobble hats. I want to see snowboarding polar bears. I want something that can be deemed festive on a motif. Any kind of festive artwork, I want all of it slapped on. I want reds and greens and silvers. I don't, you know, so I want gaudy. not classy, because if you go to some of the more upmarket establishments, they will actually have less Christmassy boxes. And actually, the cheapest on the market, which was the Tesco Standard at £2, actually had the best score for festivity, because it was lots of pictures of Santa. It's very, very, you know, it was overwhelmingly festive, and that's what I want. So that's the first F. The second F is filling. There are two categories in the filling category. The first is the depth of the filling. How much stuff have you got in there? What, you know, is it thickly stacked? Is it thinly stacked? Do they try and be deceitful by not filling right at the edges? So, you know, the bit of the sandwich that you see through the window of the sandwich box? Sometimes they kind of plump up that bit but don't have anything to the sides, but I get the bottom of that. So make sure, I like to see all sides quite uniformly deep. And whenever I'm marking depth, I also like to be able to see each component of the filling, which generally is, I want to be able to see turkey stuffing, one kind of pork product, be it ham, or sometimes bacon or sausage, and then I want to see all of that. I want it to be clearly visible. I want to see a bit of the cranberry layer. I want to see all that. And then the second aspect of the filling is the ratio of the fillings inside the sandwich. Well, I worked out in my first year of reviews that the sort of optimum ratio, to my taste, but I mean you might, so obviously taste will vary, but I think it's kind of universally that the optimum ratio is the 4-3-2-1 ratio, with four being for every four turkey, there should be three stuffing, two bacon or pork, and one cranberry. And I think a sandwich will get marked more highly if they're the closer they are to that ratio. Final criteria is obviously the overall flavour. So you get it in your mouth and you give it a good old chew. Let's have a nibble, as Simon Budge says in the videos. And you let it all. So, what's the predominant flavour? You know, is the turkey nice? Is it dry? Does the sage come in and the stuffing? Does that taste nice in your mouth? Is the cranberry of good quality? Is there too much cranberry? Is it too moist? Have they like lathered a load of mayonnaise on it? Have they, like in some sandwiches, have they put in things that you don't need in a Christmas sandwich, like spinach? A lot of pret a manger spinach, they put in spinach and crispy onions. Now that to me isn't Christmassy, so I actually take marks from them for putting those ingredients in, because it alters the taste of the Christmas sandwich, and it makes it taste less Christmassy and more just of lunch. I want the taste of Christmas lunch.
So to be a successful Christmas sandwich, does it have to be turkey stuffing, bacon? It can't be another sort of meat dish.
I mean, there are other ones available. I mean, you know, in any of these retailers, you will get the old Wensleydale and chutney or all kinds of things, and they give it a sort of a Christmassy look about it. But for me, not being a vegetarian and not wanting to have to eat literally 40 different kinds of sandwiches, I decided that what I would look for would be the classic Christmas dinner in between two bits of bread. And I mean, obviously, other sandwiches, that's fine. If you don't like turkey, if you think turkey's too dry, and your idea of a great Christmas sandwich is Wensleydale with festive chutney, that's fine. But that's not my cup of tea.
And also, to do with the things that you mark as what makes a Christmas sandwich, could you have a Christmas sandwich that has the perfect ratio and the flavours and everything, but has disappointing Christmas packaging? Or is that just overall a disappointing sandwich?
If it's got disappointing, what I do is I add the scores together. So the festivity gets a score of 10, the flavour gets a score of 10, and the filling gets a score of 10. So it's an overall experience of the sandwich that I'm looking for. Obviously, if you could look at the reviews and you could say that if you're not interested in how festive it is, you could just look at the individual score that it gets for the flavour. Or if you're not interested too much in the flavour of the festivity and you just want to get filled up, you could also look at it and you say, well, the individual score for filling in this one is the highest. I'm hungry, so let's go for that one. So for me, it's the whole experience from whenever you pick up the sandwich to whenever you finish eating it. It's like in any of these, I watch MasterChef, the professionals. Whenever a dish comes out, Michel Roux looks at it and he goes, this doesn't look very good. This doesn't look, you know, so you eat with your eyes, don't you? And it might taste amazing, but it's got to look good. Otherwise, you know, it's part of the experience is lost.
That was Adam Best chatting to me about the important things to rate in a Christmas sandwich. And if you'd like to hear more from Adam, then just head to sirenonline.co.uk and click on Food for Thought to listen to that interview in full. You can also find links to his sandwich review blog and the videos of the reviews that were done for the Poke as well. Inspired by Adam's amazing work, Food for Thought regular Jonathan Cresswell and myself walked around Lincoln to do our own version to find out what special Yuletide food can be found in our city.
We're walking in the air.
So a number of coffee shops are doing sort of Christmassy alternatives. So they'll have their hot chocolates that also taste of mint, caramel and things like that.
Gingerbread's normal as well.
But there's also some local alternatives, so Eskimos, as well as doing their normal milkshakes, are also doing hot chocolates. And they've got three in particular, Nutella, Terry's Chocolate Orange and After Eight. And now, John, you're a particular fan of the mint one.
Yeah, I've had a lot of mint hot chocolates and, yeah, you get a little taste of mint, but having this one, oh, it's a little overwhelming at first. You do get the proper full, slightly darker taste. Or the After Eight, because they use them, blend them up and stuff. So that's really nice. Very strong by the end of it. It's not for the faint-hearted. They're extremely sweet. You found that with the chocolate orange one.
Yes, the chocolate orange one was... It was sort of amazingly thick. And then after a while, once you get to the last quarter, you're like, this is very sugary, but is absolutely amazing.
Fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go... Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
We've now moved on to the High Street. And one of the first places you see when you move on to the High Street is Greg's. And so one of their Christmas choices is a chicken and bacon roll, which generally you could find at Greg's any time of the year. But this one has also got cranberry and red onion chutney in it to give it that sort of addition of Christmas. And the thing that I like that's particularly different is that to get the sort of stuffing flavour, that is the flavour of the bread roll instead, which is a nice take for me.
I've gone over to the West Cornwall Pasty Company and are going for a Boxing Day pasty. I like this one because it's got a load of stuff in it, rather than just go, oh, we put turkey and cranberry in, great. No, it's got like bacon, sausage, some nice gravy in there and potatoes. You get that nice Christmas thing of shove it all in.
We're simply having a wonderful Christmas time. Simply having a wonderful Christmas time.
So we've had our drink, we've had our sandwich, and now it's time for a little treat. And so we've come to McDonald's where they've got a Christmas menu, and their particular sweet thing is a chocolate orange flavoured pie. And so John's got one here.
I'm going to try it now. That is really nice. It's liquid, really nice chocolate with the orange flavour. You've got that nice crispy fryness to hold it in. It's really nice like this. And I don't think I'm going to be allowed any more chocolate for the rest of the week.
That was just a selection of Christmas-inspired food that can be found in and around Lincoln City Centre at the moment. If you can think of any interesting or different foods around at the moment, then just tweet me using @SirenFM or go to the website sirenonline.co.uk to find out how you can contact me, and I'll make a list on the website.
Siren 107.3 FM.
The focal point of a Christmas dinner is always the bird, but what if you're a vegetarian? Or what if you have a vegetarian coming round for Christmas dinner and you have no idea for what special and interesting meals you could make them? Well, don't worry, because earlier this week I spoke to Karen Ridges, who works at Veggie Vision TV, who passed on her words of advice.
The main thing I would say if you're catering for vegetarians and vegans at Christmas, the big tip I would say is make more than enough, because the stories I hear are that the meat eaters love all of the vegetarian options so much that they eat them all and leave the poor vegetarians going hungry. I think, you know, I don't know if I'm a typical sort of vegetarian, but I'm always running late. You know, it's just one of those things. There's too much to do and not enough time. And I hear this a lot, you know, the vegetarian or vegan guests are running late and they arrive, and the special dish that the host has made has completely and utterly disappeared. I had one lady who invented these gorgeous puff pastry with dairy-free cream cheese inside, and they were fantastic. And they literally all went. There was none left for the vegan that was looking forward to trying something different. But it became so popular, and she hosts Christmas every year, that every year, every everybody looks forward to this vegan-friendly dish, you know, no matter what they eat. So my big top tip is really do over-cater on your vegetarian and vegan options, because they are suitable for everybody, you know, not just the veggies.
And what kind of recipes would be good for Christmas Day for vegetarians or vegans?
I mean, I like to try all different sorts of things, and, you know, I like meat-free meats, you know, and a lot of sort of meat eaters don't really understand that. They say, well, why not eat meat? But, you know, there's so much more to being vegetarian and vegan than just not wanting to eat something. I mean, a lot of vegetarians and vegans like the taste of meat, but they don't want to eat an animal. Something that I'm having, and I've already tested it out, and it does taste fantastic, is my Christmas strudel with herby beanie balls. You know, it's a lovely phyllo pastry, so you've got the lovely crunchiness of the texture of the phyllo pastry. In there, we've got fried vegetarian chicken strips, so you've got the meaty texture, the tasty texture inside. That's the main part of the Christmas strudel. In there also, we've got cooked chestnuts, there's some balsamic vinegar, you've got cranberries, you've got curly kale. You know, it's a really filling, tasty centrepiece for Christmas. And we've tested this out on meat eaters and on vegetarians. And I must say, we didn't even tell the meat eaters that it was vegan. And no one batted an eyelid and just said, yeah, that's nice. You know, that's really tasty. It's got great colours in there, you know, because you're going to have your cranberry sauce on the side. I would have that with roast sweet potatoes. We've got some other dishes on there of red cabbage and ginger and green beans and carrots. So you've got some reds, some oranges, some greens. You've got this filling, healthy centerpiece. You know, that is a wonderful way, a wonderful dish. And what I really like in particular is that nothing has had to suffer or even die for my plate. You know, it's filling, it's healthy, it's tasty, and I can celebrate Christmas, you know, just like everybody else does, really. I feel in a slightly more compassionate way.
And you touched on it there. Vegetarians and vegans can have a sort of different thoughts on... So you said that you quite like eating meat-free meats, but some people might not like to. So is it important to make sure what people like before you start planning?
Definitely. I mean, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, this is my other really big tip, is communication. I mean, if you are catering for a vegetarian or vegan at Christmas, don't be afraid to pick up the phone a couple of weeks beforehand. It is all about communication. What we don't want is sitting at the table and an awkward silence, or serving something that really, you know, isn't suitable. You know, there could be an allergy. So, you know, it's all about communication. But I do feel it's both parties. I mean, if you are going to somebody's house and you are a dietary requirement, whether it's an allergy or vegetarian or vegan or whatever it is, you know, again, pick up the phone. Don't just arrive and feel that they are going to, you know, have read your mind, or, you know, they're going to put something together that's suitable. You know, have a good discussion, because what we want is a stress-free Christmas. We don't want any nasty surprises, or, you know, for you to be sitting there and think you're eating a vegetarian meal when the roast potatoes are cooked in turkey fat. I mean, that has happened, and, you know, there's been tears at the table, and it's all to do with communication. Have a chat beforehand, and equally, if you are vegetarian and vegan, offer to take something round, make the life a little bit easier. And again, take enough to share, because I have had people that have taken something, you know, just a little bit for them, and everybody wants to try it. So, you know, communication and a bit of preparation, and, you know, everybody can have a stress-free Christmas and enjoy one that, you know, they're not going against their principles either.
You mentioned there that sometimes things like people can be roasting potatoes in goose fat and things like that. What other mistakes could people make without realising that that's something that a vegetarian or a vegan wouldn't like to eat?
Sure. Well, I mean, we've had it where, you know, underneath the turkey in a big oven is the nut roast, where, you know, fat could be spitting and dripping into the nut roast. You know, most vegetarians would not like that, and most vegetarians would, you know, be upset, to be honest, you know. So make sure, if you are catering, that you cook your meat items away from the vegetarian items. It's just polite. It's just respectful. You know, and if you are using something, you know, to turn over your roast potatoes that are cooked in meat fat, you know, use a different utensil to turn over the roast potatoes that are cooked, you know, in lovely olive oil or something. So, you know, it, again, it's just finding out to what extent your person, you know, is vegetarian. You know, most vegetarians I know would really like the items to be cooked separately. But you have some that maybe are less strict.
With the meal, it's generally quite a sort of rituals of carving the turkey at the table. If you had a table of people who were meat eaters and vegetarians, what kind of ways would you go around that to make it more polite for vegetarians at the table?
Again, it's got to be communication. Me, as a vegan who is passionate about being vegan, been vegan for 10 years, vegetarian before that, you know, if I was to go around somebody's house, I think it depends on who it was, I really wouldn't be comfortable for somebody to slice up a what is essentially a dead bird in front of me. What would be the best way? Is it possible to do that beforehand and just bring the meal to the table? If it is a bit of a tradition where you do carve it up in front of people, is that person going to be offended? Some people may not be offended. Would I simply wait in a different room and then come and join the table and, you know, enjoy the festivities with everybody else? I think everybody is going to be different. And again, it's going to be the communication, having a chat beforehand and say, look, this is what we typically do. Are you going to feel happy about it? Because everybody wants to be happy. You don't want to put anyone out.
That was me chatting to Karen Ridges about how to have a happy vegetarian Christmas. Hopefully her passion has inspired you to look at Christmas differently, whether you're a vegetarian, a vegan, or even a meat eater. If you suddenly panic about what to cook and how to cook for the big day, then today's episode and last week's episode with turkey cooking tips from Rachel Green, as well as ideas for Christmas cake and foodie gifts, are all online. Just head to sarahonline.co.uk and click on Food for Thought. I hope you've enjoyed listening to these Christmas specials. I have loved making them, and now I just have one last thing to do. Merry Christmas, everyone, and I'll leave you with someone who can say that much better than me. This is Slade with Merry Christmas, everybody.